Hello and welcome to Medic in the Middle. Medic in the Middle is a podcast series hosted by myself, a registered paramedic, Thomas Alderson. Medic in the Middle is a podcast exploring a range of different topics, issues and articles. The podcast features a range of guests from different both in-hospital and pre-hospital specialties. Today I'm joined by our friend Ryan Ferris again. So, hello Ryan, cheers for coming down.
Evening Tom, no, thank you for having me again.
Ryan is a CCP with Midlands Air Ambulance and today we're going to be discussing brain impact apnea. So without further ado, let's get stuck into today's podcast. So yeah, I think we should start just a quick definition of what brain impact apnea is and you know roughly what it involves. So there's a good paper from John Hines et al. Who haven't heard of John Hines already is definitely worth going checking out. An absolute legend in his own right. Did a lot of work on sort of the motorcycle races. Unfortunately, died on a race in his line of his role. But nevertheless, he did a good paper on brain impact apnea and did a fair bit of talks and research on the topic as well. So he did a paper called The Forgotten Cause of Cardiovascular Collapse and Trauma. And it's by John Hines and Mark Wilson et al. This is from was accepted and revised in 2016. So they state that brain impact apnea is characterized by the cessation of spontaneous breathing following a traumatic brain injury or head injury insult. It's commonly accompanied by catecholamine surges, witnessed as hypertension, followed by cardiovascular collapse. This contradicts the belief that the isolated traumatic brain injury cannot be the cause of shock and raising the possibility that brain injury may be misinterpreted and therefore mismanaged in patients with isolated brain injury. So that's quite a mouthful, but essentially, that's what we're going to be kind of delving into and breaking down a little bit more today in layman's terms so we can understand what it is and how we manage it. So, Ryan, I believe you've got some notes prepped on a case study that might help to kind of put the mechanism and kind of a injury that we're talking about into context. So do you want to just fire away on what you've got case study-wise to kind of set the playing field for what it is?
Yeah, great, Tom. Thank you. I think when you asked me to speak on the topic of impact brain apnea and having spoken on it recently at a number of other resuscitation masterclass and conferences, there's one case in my mind that always sort of comes to the front of my mind when I think about impact brain apnea, and one that really stood out for me within my own clinical practice. And now aspects of this case I have fabricated to sort of try and get across the key points of impact brain apnea. But to set the scene, it was a gentleman in his 40s. He was allegedly assaulted, and the bystanders report was he was seen to take one punch to the head and fall to the floor. The gentleman, it was on a night out. He had some alcohol on board, but the bystander reported that instantly the gentleman was unconscious. Mm. So subsequently they called 999, and I believe roughly 7-8 minutes after the initial 999 call, the ambulance crew arrived. They found the patient to be unconscious. He was GCS free. He was apneic and he was centrally cyanosed. So they undertook some basic life support measures, some essential life support measures. They inserted an OP airway. Mm-hmm. They supported his ventilations with a BVM.
And is this bystander first aid?
So this is now the ambulance service arrival.
Yeah. So I was going to say some pretty impressive bystanders.
Yeah, most definitely. Doing better than I would.
Just ready on a night out with their BVM.
Yeah, so no, unfortunately in this case, there was no bystander intervention apart from the call to the emergency services.
Right, got you.
So on the crew's arrival, the ambulance crew, they inserted the airway. They supported the gentleman's ventilations. And subsequently, they requested for an enhanced care team. And that's how I came to be at the scene on this. So on our arrival, and again, the patient, he was a GCSO3. He had an episodic ventilatory pattern, but he did have a central pulse palpable. Subsequently, from a neuroprotective means, securing his airway, we undertook a pre-hospital emergency anaesthetic and took the gentleman to the nearest MTC.
Yep.
Unfortunately, it's a very sad outcome for this gentleman. This gentleman didn't go on to survive. But what we found on his CT scan was that actually he had no structural injury.
So he had no like parenchymal.
Exactly that.
Parenchymal injury.
Parenchymal injury. Yeah, so he had no parenchymal injury, or structural injury noted on his CT scan. But what there was a clear loss of grey white matter differentiation and an evidence of a hypoxic brain injury.
Mm.
And I think this always really sticks out in my mind. And I think we hear these cases quite a lot, and some of these cases being fabricated when we talk about impact brain apnea. But it's always that question of one punch to the head, and this gentleman subsequently suffered a severe hypoxic brain injury.
So it's not a huge mechanism as you'd expect with your normal kind of traumatic brain injury, is it, where there is that structural difference? This is just a punch to the head on a night out that's led to that.
And it's exactly that. It was the mechanism of injury, the energy transfer. It shouldn't have produced the outcome that we've seen in this case. And it just made me think, and we talk a lot about this, and when other people talk around the subject of impact brain apnea, I just wonder how that outcome would differ if there was bystander intervention, if the ambulance crew arrived 2 minutes too earlier.
Yeah.
And I think we do see this within the literature. We see this a lot within motorcycle sports. And I think we'll probably come on to talk about that through the podcast.
Yeah, sure.
But I think it's really just to set the tone that what relatively was a low energy transfer, low mechanism of injury, should that have produced the outcome that we've seen in this case? And perhaps it shouldn't have. Perhaps, it was the fact that this gentleman had an obstructed airway. There was a delay to correcting his airway. He had an abnormal ventilatory pattern. And actually, the injury was survivable. But due to the delay in care, unfortunately, he didn't survive in this instance. I think this just sort of sets the scene for how we may improve care in the future going forward.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, mate. Yeah, cheers for that. That's really cool to kind of set the scene and just set the context for these kind of injury patterns. So the brain then is made up of the following parts. You have the cerebrum. The cerebrum is comprised of the two hemispheres that are separated by the longitudinal tissue, or the cerebral fissure. You've got your cerebellum, which is the lower inferior part, which is inferior to the occipital lobe of the cerebrum. And then you've got your brainstem, which comprises of the medulla oblongata and the pons, and also the midbrain. These particular parts are the parts that are responsible for respiration, cardiac function, vasodilation, and particularly the medulla oblongata. So when the patients have these kind of injuries, or that they've had that insult, as we mentioned, with the chap that's being punched over the head, being assaulted on a night out, the patient then enters the what we call the critical phase. According to Life in the Fast Lane's description of this sort of patho, they call the first 10 minutes following this injury or insult the critical phase, which is the first 10 minutes or the first few minutes following that insult. And then it's followed by sort of exponential plateau and resolution phases. But the initial critical phase, all we need to kind of bear in mind for this, to simplify it down, is that you've got two key components. So you've got the apneic phase, and you've also got the catecholamine surge. So the apneic always occurs following sort of, well, with or following the concussive injury, so that initial shaking or disruption to the midbrain stem that you've got, that is what's thought to be a sort of a reflex of the medulla oblongata having that trauma. So you've got that, the medulla oblongata and the midbrain stem, it's a direct reflex to that concussive injury you've got, and that's what induces the apneic stage. Following that, you've got this massive sympathetic discharge that occurs, which we call the catecholamine surge, which results in hypertension. That hypertension then compounds hypercapnia, induced cerebral vasodilation. But we'll get into a little bit more of the patho on the sort of the two main phases to do with apnea and catecholamine surge shortly. Ryan, do you want to kind of talk us through the kind of upcoming of this insult and the kind of the, any studies that have been associated with it to kind of support the patterns that follow the injury?
Yeah, I think you've touched on some really good points there. And I think number one, you alluded to the fact that this is a brainstem mediated event.
You nailed it on the head earlier, saying with the CT scans that these patients have had, they haven't actually got any indicative massive brain injury themselves on CT scans. There's no like actual tissue damage or midline shifts or anything like that you get with your normal TBIs.
Quite. And I think, as we said, if this is a brainstem mediated event, but on CT scans, these patients, they don't have structural injury, they don't have parenchymal injury. That suggests that it is a reflex. Mm-hmm. And if it is a reflex, as such, it can be, not reversed, but it can be prevented.
Yeah.
If this is a reflex, intervention from ourselves, from bystanders, from the ambulance crews, we can prevent this sort of horrific outcome that these patients suffer when actually their injury may be survivable.
Yeah, absolutely. And
I think this has been well documented within the animal literature over the years. I think if you do a search of impact brain apnea, I think the first study was in 1874, which is an animal study, which described this respiratory response to head injury. I think the seminal paper when we talk about impact brain apnea was from Atkinson in 1998. And I think it's seminal in the sense that this was the first piece of literature that graphically depicted the respiratory response to head injury.
Uh-huh.
And again, it's one of those subjects. It's quite hard to talk about impact brain apnea without talking about this study. And I'm sure most of your listeners have most likely read this. But just to summarize it, it was 18 anaesthetized rats. They were spontaneously breathing, and what they did, they broke them into four separate groups, and they were subjected to varying degrees of fluid percussion.
Mm-hmm.
They monitored the rats' blood pressure, their ICP, and their respiratory pattern. And what they found and what they were able to graphically depict was that the period of apnea and the degree of respiratory recovery was directly proportional to the amount of force that had been exerted and transferred to the brainstem.
Those poor rats.
I'm not a fan of mice, rats, rodents. I don't think any of them should come to harm, but I didn't lose any sleep over it. Sorry to the listeners. But it was a really interesting paper. And when you can see this graphically depicted, I think it's fantastic. So in group A, they had this, we'll call it a moderate degree of force. And you see the period of apnea, but then a normal respiratory pattern takes over again.
Mm-hmm.
In the next group, and subsequently with varying and more severe degrees of fluid percussion, you see the period of apnea or respiratory dysfunction extending. You see a rise in their systolic blood pressure. You see a rise in their ICP. And to the point when then the most severe groups in group C, where they had the greatest degree of fluid percussion to the head, that actually without intervention, that apnea persisted, that ICP remained high.
Mm.
So yeah, really interesting topic, and definitely a brainstem mediated event.
They did a study, I've got one here that they did as well. Sorry to interrupt.
No.
But a similar kind of study, there's a chap called Raphael's 2011 and Raphael's 2012. So they studied an explosive blast waves and their effect on animals. So similar to the percussive study with the rats. So they kind of studied the effect of explosive blast waves and their effect on the respiratory patterns. Apnea was noted in both of the studies, and with the duration of apnea being proportionate to the blast force themselves given off. So it's just interesting that both studies have found that the apnea periods have been directly proportionate to the force exerted on the brain or on the midbrain stem.
Yeah, quite right. And I think this just, well, we've said this already, but I think that will sort of solidify the fact that this is a brain stem mediated event.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's got to be kind of, to understand it, I suppose, it's got to be differentiated. You know, you've got to kind of put traumatic brain injuries in one pot and then apneic brain injuries in another, haven't you, really? They're two completely separate. I think they kind of get confused a little bit. But you really have got to try and separate. This is a totally different kettle of fish, isn't it? Brain injury.
I think the initial management and the subsequent management, even from ourselves, probably does remain the same.
Mm-hmm.
With the emphasis being on the first aid from the bystanders, undertaking good sort of neuroprotective measures, undertaking intervention to prevent secondary brain injury. And actually, I think it was Mark Wilson, you'll have to excuse me, but who actually described apnea as the most immediate form of secondary brain injury.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really powerful statement, because when we talk about secondary brain injury, we think about preventing the hypotension, we think about preventing the hypoxia.
Yeah.
Temperature management, making sure that the blood sugars are corrected.
Mm-hmm.
but actually we don't consider apnea as a form of secondary brain injury or as a preventable means of secondary brain injury. So I think that's a really powerful message, and one that we need to take wider than just the ambulance service, but to the public. And it really does emphasize the importance of this sort of essential life support.
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly in cases, like you said, where you are getting cases of somebody who's been assaulted in the street and the patient appears to be unresponsive, but apnea can, there is that lack of wider perception of management of that. And I think if there were, like you said, wider than the ambulance service, if there was that kind of knowledge base out there that with these blows to the head, you can get this, like you said, these sort of primary / secondary insults of apnea.
Yeah, quite right. Because I think, sorry, I interrupted you. I think if we use the case we talked about at the start, patients who don't breathe as a result of a brain injury, they're distinctively different from those who aren't ventilating due to airway obstruction. In the brain injured patient, the process of opening the airway alone, undertaking some essential life support, may actually be enough to initiate spontaneous breathing within that patient. So they're two very different pathophysiological processes.
Yeah, yeah.
But a very simple intervention could be enough to start that spontaneous respiration again.
So we kind of talked a little bit earlier about kind of simply breaking this injury pattern down. We talked about the main two things we've got to worry about with brain impact apnea, and that was the apneic stage and the catecholamine surge stage. So we focused primarily on number one, which is the apneic stage. So if we just focus on the problems that that can bring. So for the apneic patient that doesn't recover from this respiratory drive from the concussion, we can kind of predict their outcome already. They're going to experience death or certainly a poor neurological outcome from a prolonged hypoxia.
Yeah.
So apnea following the head injury contributes to all kinds of problems later on down the road, like you've already mentioned about secondary insults that can sort of accelerate the formation of other problems like edema and intracranial pressure and ischemia and death of neuronal tissues, but also starvation of oxygen to other kind of vital tissues as well. Do you want to run us through like a little bit about those, well, a bit more depth about like those kind of effects that can occur with that hypoxia and that kind of initial apneic stage?
I think if we sort of would take it back a little bit and summarize it, and again there's perhaps not much more to say on the apnea and the hypoxia with regards to impact brain apnea. I think the first thing to perhaps allude to, and perhaps it's good to have an awareness, is actually if we take the patient with a head injury who's also got alcohol on board, I think that's worth a consideration. There were some animal studies that actually showed the effects of alcohol exaggerate the effects of head injury. So there was a study in 1995 which looked at the effects of ethanol in the respiratory function in traumatic brain injured patients. And what that actually showed was if you have alcohol within your system and you sustain a concussive force to your head, you increase your period of apnea, but not only can you increase it, you also decrease the threshold for apnea to occur.
Okay.
So if we relate that back to the sort of the case study we talked about at the start of this podcast, perhaps why we've seen such an exaggerated response initially was also because this gentleman had alcohol
on
board.
Yeah, on a night out, yeah.
So not only you've got the concern of prolonging the apnea, but having a decrease threshold to become apneic. Yeah,
which hence why, you know, that single blow to the head by just, you know, a punch, no weapons, was enough to cause him to die.
Yeah, I think it's very likely multifactorial in all these cases, but that definitely, I truly believe, is probably a contributing factor in some of these one-punch cases that we all too often and unfortunately come across.
Yeah.
We've alluded to this already, but as you quite rightly said, it's a brainstem mediated event. So we have a concussive force to the head, and this results in this ventilatory dysfunction, abnormal respiratory pattern to the extreme of apnea. And recently, it's impact brain apnea. It's now, or at least the apneic effects of head injury or the respiratory dysfunction of head injury. We've started to see this terminology of commotio medullaris.
That's a cool term.
Being bandied around. It took me a long time trying to say that.
It sounds like some kind of like Marvel baddie, doesn't it?
Don't get me talking about Marvel because we're going to go way off here. But I think it's a really simple term when you look at the Latin aspect of it. And I imagine some of your listeners have likely heard this terminology of commodio medullaris, but more likely they've heard the term of commodio cordis, with commodio being shaken and cordis being hurt. Mm-hmm. So we are aware, and we've all read the literature around these cases where somebody sustains a blunt trauma to the chest and subsequently have a life-threatening arrhythmia. And that's exactly the same when we talk about impact brain apnea or commodio medullaris. It's the shaking force to the brainstem, to the medulla specifically, which you alluded to earlier. But I think the big thing, and we again, to try and summarize this, is this period of apnea is dependent on the initial intervention that happens. So if we've got a bystander who's trained in first aid or is comfortable to put that patient into the recovery position, open their airway, that may in turn be all that's required for this individual to have a good outcome.
Yeah.
So I think when we're talking about impact brain apnea, what we have to remember is essential first aid and rescue ventilation actually does equal intact survival.
Yeah.
If the rest of the management is correct. But if we use the example where that apnea persists, the patient becomes profoundly hypoxic,
they're
going to subsequently become profoundly acidotic, they're going to become hypercapnic, exactly that, then we are going to see a cardiovascular collapse.
Yeah.
And I think this is quite often a forgotten cause of cardiogenic shock.
Yeah.
We don't see the isolated head injury as a cause of hypotension.
No, absolutely not. No.
And I think historically, if you looked at ATLS teachings or PHTLS teachings, the literature was always you can't be hypotensive
in with the head, yeah. Everyone just thinks head injury, they're going to be massively hypertensive. But
yes, quite. And I think the reason for that is we're probably, when we're saying you can't be hypotensive as a result of a head injury, I think we're very likely talking about you can't exsanguinate from a head injury and be hypotensive. But that's not the reason we're hypotensive within these patient cohorts. It's the cardiovascular collapse that follows that persistent apnea, hypoxia, the acidosis that follows. And when you apply that alongside, as you said, the other aspect of impact brain apnea is this initial catecholamine surge. We then see this cardiac dysfunction. And I think that's a really, really key point to take from this, that just because the patient's got an isolated head injury, that does not mean that they can't be hypotensive.
Yep.
We're very likely to see that cardiovascular collapse in these patients if treatment isn't initiated quickly.
Yeah.
If we can get to the patient, open an airway, provide ventilation, we can prevent that hypoxia, we can prevent that acidosis, and subsequently we may not see that degree of cardiac dysfunction.
I was looking at some of the notes took from the article. Isolated traumatic brain injury results in similar, significant rather, pre-hospital derangement of cardiovascular physiology. Took some notes from that on the catecholamine storm. So you've mentioned about the cardiovascular collapse. So it results in vasoconstriction, increased cardiac afterload, which we get from that sort of systemic vasoconstriction, an increase in myocardial oxygen demand, and that results in subendocardial ischemia or impaired ventricular function, which then can lead to the hypertension. I just like the way that that's structured.
Yeah, I think it's a really nice summary. And within that paper, if you go on to read through it, again, I think it says a lot more eloquently what I'm just trying to say about cardiovascular collapse.
Can you pronounce his name a little better than I can?
No, I'm not even going to try.
Gavrilowski.
It's just about to speak English.
Yeah.
But they have some really interesting sort of statistics within that paper. And I say it puts it a lot more eloquently than me trying to say you can be hypotensive in the presence of an isolated traumatic brain injury. But within one of their studies, Hassan, in 2016, they found that 50% of patients with traumatic brain injury had a form of cardiovascular dysfunction. 32% of that 50% presented with hypotension not related to volume depletion. And again, I think that's a really powerful statement. Similarly, a case from Ken Surrey in Sussex, I believe, they found that 44% of their TBI patients had cardiovascular abnormalities, pre-RSI, and those abnormalities were a heart rate greater than 100 or a systolic blood pressure below 100. Hypotension with or without tachycardia was present in 12% of those patients, And those are big figures. Those aren't small patient cohorts who are having cardiac dysfunction presence.
There's that tendency to assume that a lot of this hypotension is going to be coming from extracranial injuries, isn't there? Like, by that, I just mean injuries outside of the brain, from polytrauma or from exsanguination, like you mentioned. But it's really interesting to see that a lot of these cases of these brain insults or head injuries, it comes part and parcel of that potential, cardiovascular collapse that's associated with the physiology of the brain injury itself.
And I think acknowledging that as clinicians is really important. I think acknowledging that in the isolated traumatic brain injured patient, they may have cardiovascular instability. And I think that's really crucial for ensuring that we deliver optimal care. And as clinicians, we need to accurately establish or at least have a working diagnosis of the cause of that cardiovascular instability.
Yeah.
Because that's really going to determine and really alter and change the treatment. So, for instance, if we take the hypovolemic patient or the hypotensive patient, where we suspect the cause to be from exsanguination, the treatment choice for them may be volume resuscitation with blood products. We may want to implement a strategy of permissive hypotension. And if we're incorrectly diagnosing the isolated head injured patient, if we're implementing a strategy of permissive hypotension, then we're subsequently having negative effects from a secondary brain injury prevention. If our MAP's not high enough or cerebral perfusion pressure is not high enough, then we are contributing to these secondary brain injuries.
Yeah.
Whereas if we do acknowledge that these isolated traumatic brain injury patients may have a degree of cardiovascular instability, then our treatment choices may change. Instead of volume resuscitation with blood products and, permissive hypotension, we may actually consider a form of vasopressor resuscitation and trying to improve their MAP and their cerebral perfusion pressure to reduce the negative effects of secondary brain injury, and subsequently undertake these interventions alongside a pre-hospital anaesthetic, for example.
It's just deciding which road to navigate yourself down, isn't it? So you've got to, and like you said, it just comes from a good history taking and mechanism of what's involved. And I suppose where it becomes particularly difficult is those polytrauma patients with multiple injury patterns. But as we said, with the isolated head injury, the case study at the start, the man's been punched in the head. Yeah, I suppose it helps it a little bit more, just that history taking of what's gone on, into which road we might navigate ourselves down for management of just things you've just been talking about.
Yeah, quite right. And I suppose if we consider how we can help ourselves as clinicians differentiate between the two, I think end-tidal CO2 plays a really vital role in the isolated traumatic brain injured patient. So if we take those two examples again, the hypovolemic patient and the isolated traumatic brain injury, the hypovolemic patient, we know they're going to be hypocapnic.
Yep.
They're going to be hypocapnic for a number of reasons. And we know one of the reasons for this, we know in the hypovolemic patient, in the bleeding patient, one of the body's first responses to do is to mount an increased respiratory rate, to mount a tachypnea. And we do this, the body does this, I don't do this, the body does this to generate a compensatory respiratory alkalosis for what is a metabolic acidosis. And secondly, if we are bleeding, we're going to have a reduced preload, and subsequently we're going to have a reduced right ventricular output, and subsequently a reduced cardiac output.
Yep.
So we know that we're going to be hypocapnic for all of these reasons we discussed. Whereas in the isolated traumatic brain injured patient, or the patient suffering from a potential impact brain apnea, we know that the preload isn't affected. They're not exsanguinating. They're not losing blood. So our cardiac output's not affected. And as such, VQ or perfusion or ventilation, it's matched. And as such, we have a normal end-tidal CO2.
Yep.
What we may see is a resultant hypercapnia. And that's a centrally mediated event. So if we've had a concussive force to the head, we have a centrally mediated hypoventilation, which is going to in turn result in this hypercapnia.
So in terms of how common these injury patterns are, and this insult is of impact brain apnea. Literature-wise, is there a massive amount of evidence base to support like how often it's happening or the incidence of it? And, you know, I suppose there's kind of limiting factors we have to take into account with that evidence base, isn't there, behind the how common this occurs?
I don't think there is, and I think definitely historically when we first started talking about this impact brain apnea, this commodio medullaris, I think the topic or the phenomenon, as it was described, was quite controversial in itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was probably controversial in the sense that actually it wasn't being observed. There's not a vast amount of literature, and there's no real diagnostic criteria for it. As we described earlier, that CT scan, it was normal. If we change some interventions, there's no structural injury. So it is underappreciated. It's underrepresented in the literature. And from my own sort of personal feelings, I think that's for two reasons. I think the patient who suffers that head injury, the impact brain apnea, I think they either have one or two paths which follows from that. Number one is they get some immediate essential life support. They have a bystander who places them in the recovery position. They open their airway.
Yeah.
And by the time we as clinicians get to the patient's side, they're spontaneously breathing again.
Yeah, and that goes back to kind of what we were talking about with the proportionate force to the level of apnea that they're experiencing.
Yeah, doesn't it? Quite right.
They've had a minor concussion or a minor kind of reflex of the medulla, and they've had a very brief period of apnea. Like you said, by the time we get to them, someone's put them in the recovery position, they've opened their airway, they're going to have started to spontaneously breathe again, and it's not recognised, is it?
Yeah, no, exactly that. And then on the other extreme of that, you have a patient who has a concussive force delivered to their brainstem. There's a delay within their care, their intervention. There's no bystander intervention. And as such, at the point where we get them, they're in what we deem to be a traumatic cardiac arrest state.
Yeah.
So we don't actually see that process in between.
Uh-huh. They've gone from being apneic to the point where they've just gone into like you said, traumatic cardiac arrest, what will present to us. They've had a head injury, now they're in arrest. But essentially, it's more of a hypoxic cardiac arrest, isn't it?
Really? Exactly that. Exactly. And we don't see the trajectory or the downward trajectory of that patient's physiology because there's a delay in us getting there.
And also, I think you mentioned earlier, we end up kind of potentially doing these patients almost like a disservice as a result of that sort of failure to recognize the condition and it not being a very well represented condition. We then take it as clinicians possibly down a traumatic cardiac arrest route, maybe sort of think about our HOT principles and things like that, and then, or you know, if there's a tendency to take it down a medical route and we start doing CPR and prioritizing good chest compressions, early defibrillation, do we delay ventilations then, and they're sort of profound hypoxia?
Yeah, quite. I'm probably going to sound a bit controversial here, and whilst I'm a very big advocate of the HOT principles, my concern is that as healthcare providers in general, no matter what your background, I think if we're faced with the patient in traumatic cardiac arrest, I think HOT principles has become such a, I was going to say hot topic.
Hot topic.
excuse me. That almost, no matter what the etiology of that cardiac arrest is, people feel like we need to intubate them, we need to do thoracostomies, put a pelvic binder on, delay CPR. Whereas actually, and I think we talked about this in a previous podcast, you have to have a working diagnosis of what the cause of that cardiac arrest was. If that's a patient with a high spinal injury who's got unopposed parasympathetic activity, they've got widespread vasodilation, then actually a medical cardiac arrest, ALS, where you're doing CPR, you're providing adrenaline, you're getting the alpha effects of adrenaline, you're getting the beta effects of adrenaline, that's
not
appropriate.
Not going to do a lot for our neurogenic shock.
This is it, and you have to think about that, whereas actually if we approach that same patient, ignore the fact that they need some support from a neuroprotective means and deliver bilateral thoracostomies, apply a pelvic binder, delay CPR, then that's not the optimal care for that patient. And I'm going off on a bit of a tangent, I do apologize, but I think when we are faced with any of these patients, be it pre-hospital or in hospital, you as a clinician, need to decide what was the cause of that arrest of the patient in front of me. Do I think that it's a polytrauma, multi-system insult, or do I need to target my resuscitation efforts to X, Y, and Z. And that's really difficult, and only with experience can you achieve that, only with history of what happened to that patient.
Yeah, and particularly navigating through we won't go through it in this podcast, but navigating yourself through those human factors as part of that as well.
Yeah.
That tunnel vision, that, you know, massive cognitive strain on these, what can be sometimes like a traumatic environment to walk into.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. So I apologize going off on a bit of a tangent, but I think it's really pertinent to what we're talking about there. Back to your question. No, there's not much literature out there. I think the literature that there is, and you've already alluded to some of these papers with Garth Davies and John Hines, the literature comes from the motorsport industry.
Yeah.
And very much specifically motorbikes, motorcycles, so the Northwest 200, the Isle of Man TT. And I think we see, not a lot, but in the grand scheme of things, we see a lot more reported cases of likely impact brain apnea. And I think that's, again, for a number of reasons. Number one, they see a lot of head injuries.
Yep.
These guys are driving at 200 miles per hour down country roads. Yep. They're going to see a lot of head injuries. But probably more than that is they've got rapid on-scene times. They're quite often witnessing the accident happen in front of them.
Yeah, the doctors are often part of the race, aren't they, on a bike?
Yeah, very much so. So again, with their rapid on-scene times, like you alluded to earlier, they're often there within this sort of initial critical phase of hyperacute head injury. And if you're there within this sort of rapid seconds to minutes of the incident happen, you quite likely see the first stages of the dying process, and you get to witness that pathology changing. Mm-hmm. And as such, I think that's why we see so much of it within the literature. I think more so now as well, we've got the introduction of the Good Sam app,
yep,
which again, I think is worth everybody looking at. But again, if we are if we are sort of making these bystanders aware that there's an incident close to them, perhaps we're getting to these patients much quicker, we're opening their airway, we're placing them in the recovery position. And by doing so, we prevent that hypoxia, that hypercapnia, that prolonged apneic period that we've alluded to. And as such, we don't see the cardiovascular collapse.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't get to that stage.
It doesn't get to that stage. So I think when you look at it from that perspective, it's really easy to understand why there's not a lot within the literature.
Yeah. So we're coming to that part of the podcast now where we are going to summarize the key points covered during this podcast. So brain impact apnea is an event that occurs or can occur with any concussive brain injury and is proportional to the force transmitted to the brainstem. The critical phase of the injury is often thought to be within the first sort of minutes or 10 minutes of the injury itself. We get the apneic phase combined with the catecholamine surge, and these two combined together with hypoxia and acidosis from the apneic phase and the catecholamine surge can lead to cardiac dysfunction or cardiovascular collapse. Ryan, is there anything you want to sort of summarize to that? I think other than, you know, from my kind of takeaway, it's all about just basic management, doing the basics well. Like you said, airway management and simple airway junk, so just making sure the airway is patent and history taken to get the mechanisms right in our minds as to where we think might have caused this patient to be in the condition that they are in, and just good oxygenation to provide good neuroprotecting measures. Is there anything else you want to summarize?
No, I think about? Quite right, Tom. I think you've sort of summarized it really, really nice there. And I think one of the key points, as we alluded to earlier, was exactly as you've just said, in these patient cohorts, early but essential intervention, the simple intervention of opening someone's airway and providing some ventilatory support could actually result in intact survival within these patients. And I think the really key factor there is intact survival, but neurologically intact, so they go home to their normal quality of life. For me, a couple of take-home points, and it's the same take-home points that we talk about a lot when we talk about head injury, no matter what form, but for me, all secondary brain injury, it is preventative if we appropriately treat that in a timely fashion. And I think more so when we're talking about impact brain apnea specifically, as clinicians, whether that's hospital-based or pre-hospital clinicians, just having an appreciation and an awareness that this phenomenon actually does exist. Because as clinicians, we really do have the opportunity to alter the trajectory of these patients and dramatically improve outcomes. But I don't think I've got much more to say. I think I've probably waffled on enough.
No, for you. That's brilliant. Well, everyone, I hope you've enjoyed listening to the show. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at MedicMiddle if you'd like further sort of updates on all things Medic in the Middle, further shows, and if you'd like to kind of feedback on the show, then give us a follow and say hello. But Ryan, cheers for coming down and doing the podcast again. Really do appreciate it. It's great to have your expertise and knowledge on the show.
No, thank you for having me, Tom.
Cheers for coming down.
Appreciate it.
So thank you for listening. Stay safe, and we will see you next time.